The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The North Carolina Reading Service brings you Indie Week. This issue, read by John Federson, is dated September 2nd, 2020. And our lovely theme music today is played by installing the Poland Park Carousel in our office hallway and purchasing a ticket. Costly, but we do think that you are worth it. And this week's issue includes two articles they consider op-ed, and I will read one of them now and the other if I have a chance to get to it before we end the broadcast. The UNC's Twin Diseases, written by Don Nonini, who is a professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. North Carolina undertook a frightening, poorly planned experiment in August when wary parents drove their teenage children to University of North Carolina campuses to begin the fall semester in the midst of a deadly pandemic. Despite reassurances from UNC administrators about safety protocols, there's little doubt that the push for in-person classes was driven to a large degree by financial fears. A surge in COVID-19 cases in early August followed the return of 19,000 undergraduates to UNC Chapel Hill, leading to the closing of campus to most students and a shift to online instruction after only 1 week of classes. Financial losses from the pandemic and a badly flawed roadmap to open campus will be enormous. Similar openings followed by COVID-19 outbreaks, rapid reclosings, and financial losses occurred at NC State and East Carolina University. In a recent video, UNC Board of Governors Chair Randy Ramsey said that, quote, like any other business CEO, his job is to tell everyone at UNC that they should prepare for 25 to 50% cuts, including layoffs of large numbers of faculty and staff. Mandates to prepare for cuts have come down to campuses from the Board of Governors. When they seized control of the North Carolina government in 2010, Republicans vowed to turn the UNC system into a profitable business or degrade it when they could not. This business model is now foundering. What the BOG and UNC administrators leave out of their news releases is the role their business model has played in creating the current crisis. Beyond COVID-19, parents of the UNC system students have experienced sticker shock from costs that have ratcheted up 87% since 2010, according to the Budget and Tax Center. The bill for an in-state student at UNC Chapel Hill is now $24,300 for tuition, fees, room, and board. The hikes belie the provision in the state's constitution that higher education is, quote, as far as practicable, be extended to the people of the state free of expense. In a state where the median family income is $54,000, this has forced many students into debt. The cuts are part and parcel of Republican devotion to shrinking government. In 2013, after winning a racially gerrymandered victory and getting Republican Pat McCrory elected governor, conservative majorities in the NC House and Senate rammed through regressive income and corporate tax cuts and increased sales taxes in a reactionary assault on ordinary North Carolinians. Despite publicly bemoaning high taxes, Republican legislators increased average income taxes for the bottom 80% of taxpayers, while cutting taxes for the top 1% by an average of $940,000. They failed to close tax loopholes for the wealthy and increased sales taxes, which most heavily impact low-income residents. They eliminated the state's earned income tax credit, harming the poorest citizen, while reducing the corporate income tax rate from 6.9% in 2012 to 3%. By 2017, effectively providing their corporate donors with a 57% tax cut, according to a 2013 Budget and Tax Center report. As a result, state government revenues declined by $1.5 billion by 2015, the BTC reported. because the effects of tax cuts worsen over time. In 2019 alone, the state government lost $3.6 billion in revenues. The cumulative cuts have produced an astounding $12 billion in lost revenue since 2013, BTC Director Alexander Sirota wrote in a July 27th email. These effects played out as, quote, management flexibility cuts imposed on UNC campuses by the Board of Governors between 2010 and 2015, amounting to almost $680 million. UNC's employees' wages and salaries have declined in real terms, except for administrators. Programs have been closed, and some of the system's most gifted faculty have left for more attractive positions elsewhere. State funding per student declined 11% over the same period. The UNC business model amounts to a scheme to squeeze revenues out of the families of its student customers and has been especially harmful to poor students and students of color. It creates an unbearable burden on young adults, as many students have taken on debt or full-time work to pay tuition bills. The COVID-19 pandemic now threatens the viability of UNC's business models. UNC Chapel Hill's roadmap for reopening campus, which defied recommendations from local health officials, proved to be a public health disaster with 1,100 COVID cases at press time. And its human and financial costs are still mounting. Recent openings of the other UNC system campuses to more than 220,000 undergraduates are similarly predictable debacles. What to do now in the midst of the pandemic? First, on November 3rd, voters must throw out the free market ideologues in the North Carolina General Assembly who don't know the meaning of public education. They must elect responsible lawmakers who will act in the public interest, not as plutocrats' mouthpieces. They must rescind the huge tax cuts for corporations and the wealthiest families, as well as regressive sales taxes, to undo the massive damage already done. The goal over the next decade should be to build a more equitable tax system to support higher education and reduce tuition and fees while forgiving or restructuring student debt to make access to higher education accessible for all. The new government in Raleigh should create or demand federal support for relief packages for UNC campuses facing COVID-19 budget crises. The UNC system should be given access to the state's $1.2 billion rainy day fund to meet funding shortfalls at smaller campuses and those historically serving Black and American Indian students. The two campuses that hold multi-billion dollar endowments, UNC Chapel Hill and NC State, should draw on those funds to bridge their budgets until the COVID crisis abates. The pandemic makes clear that the free marketeer's fealty to for-profit education is a chronic disease afflicting the UNC system. The therapy is obvious. It's time to rescue public higher education from the hostile forces arrayed against it by voting for change. And next news from a column by Sarah Pequeño, Dirty Rush. On August 4th, the day after students returned to UNC Chapel Hill, the door of an off-campus house opened, and the sidewalk was flooded with two dozen girls going out together. They were dressed to be seen, outfits mulled over between friends, long hair brushed down their backs, $500 golden goose sneakers pre-scuffed and graffitied to make them look lived in. There was only one accessory missing. Despite the ongoing pandemic and strict rules put out by the university, none wore masks. The girls strolled side by side, shouting and giggling as they ignored their neighbor standing in her driveway, phone in hand. The video of their Chapel Hill parade was soon circulating on Twitter, spurring criticism of the lack of face coverings and social distancing and concerns about what even less safe party they were heading to. In retrospect, it was just the beginning. The video was quickly tied to Chi Omega, the oldest sorority at UNC Chapel Hill. The next day, an emergency meeting of the Faculty Executive Committee convened to discuss concerns, and the video made its way to CNN after the school announced it would shift to remote learning August 17. But the Greek life parties didn't stop then. The next weekend, UNC's Beta Theta Pi and Zeta Psi chapter houses were cited by Chapel Hill police for holding large parties with loud music. 2 weeks later, the school announced that Zeta Psi had a cluster, an outbreak of five or more cases. Parties were also reported at Phi Gamma Delta and Phi Delta Theta. Two members of Phi Delta, Dewey Ferris and James Dolman, were charged with misdemeanors. On August 29th, the UNC student filmed groups of women going into Pi Lambda Phi fraternity, the house next to Zeta Psi. The student who shared the footage on Instagram said he saw almost 40 people enter the house. When the video got back to fraternity members, they tried to explain themselves to the poster, who wishes to remain unnamed after receiving threatening text messages, and claimed there were nowhere close to 40 girls in the house last night and there was no party occurring. We brought a couple of close friends who are girls over to meet some of the potential new members, and that is it, the Pi Lam member wrote in texts reviewed by the Indy. In a typical year, the first ragers of the semester are centered around Greek life recruitment, potential new members, PNMs, or those attempting to join a Greek organization will jump from party to party at the frat houses to meet brothers. Sorority women use the fraternity houses for recruitment, too. PNMs show up to the party and end up speaking to groups of women in the same organization. None of these are official recruitment events and could lead to fines every year. They're also a yearly tradition for the school's most elite organizations, but this year isn't a typical year. Greek life isn't pandemic-proof, and a recruitment process that thrives on face-to-face interaction, as well as alcohol and drugs, quickly created a breeding ground for the coronavirus. UNC Chapel Hill's Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life, which helms the Interfraternity Council, IFC, Pan-Hellenic Association, and two multicultural Greek councils rushed to make a decision on recruitment the week the university announced its plan to reopen. On July 1, Pan-Hellenic opened its recruitment registration. The IFC posted its information on July 21st. The two Greek councils were supposed to hold Virtual Rush, where sorority or fraternity members would hop on a Zoom chat to meet potential new members. The university says this plan was outlined on June 30th, but not presented to the councils until August the 3rd, the same day students officially began moving into dormitories and the day before the Chi Omega party. But like the annual illusion of dry rush, virtual rush was only a solution in theory. Students told the Indy there were still off-campus parties, dinner events, and other in-person opportunities to meet the brothers. These groups depend on recruitment to repopulate after seniors graduate each spring. At schools like UNC, a pledge class could include up to 50 new members, depending on the organization. Since UNC Chapel Hill typically recruits in the fall, the organization's budget for the influx of tens of thousands of dollars that comes with a new pledge class. The organization need these finances to pay their housing staff, upkeep the house, and pay fees. This money also pays for parties and mixers. Aside from finances, recruitment is a means of maintaining an organization's tier, their spot in the social hierarchy of the school's Greek system. This not only affects their time at UNC Chapel Hill, but stretches into the real world. The Hussman School of Media and Journalism is named after a member of Delta Kappa Epsilon. Dean Smith's son, Scott, was a DKE too. At NC State University, this process for recruitment led to 13 reported COVID-19 clusters in Greek housing, more than a third of all outbreaks on campus. As of this week, more than 800 students tested positive for the virus, and another 1,000 remain quarantined due to potential exposures. UNC, by comparison, reported that 1,100 students have tested positive thus far. But fewer UNC Chapel Hill cases have been associated with Greek life, or at least that's what's been reported. Only Zeta Psi, Sigma Nu, and Alpha Delta Pi sorority have reported clusters to the university. While the numbers are lower, Chapel Hill students report that friends and classmates are circumventing the school's records by getting tested off campus and failing to self-report these cases. Other students left campus for their hometowns and got tested there. University administration is aware of this. In an August 25th email, Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Amy Johnson sent a letter to all members of UNC fraternities and sororities reminding them that noncompliance could result in legal trouble. Quote, we have also received reports of fraternity and sorority members being discouraged by their chapters from testing to avoid quarantine or isolation measures in the event of positive results. These practices cannot continue and jeopardize the health of not only chapter members, but peers, family members, and people in the local community. We expect and require your collective leadership and action to ensure that all requirements are being followed. NC State's administration has expressed similar frustration with its Greek organizations. In the school's email announcement about switching to remote instruction, Chancellor Randy Woodson blamed the campus spread on large parties and said the school had 7 Greek houses quarantining at the time. Some feel the COVID problem is just the tip of the Greek life iceberg and believe it's time for the organizations to disband. Pushback against Greek life is growing, and students are sharing stories of discrimination and harassment anonymously through an Instagram page called Abolish NCSU if Canned Panhel. The page also shares screenshots from group messages of fraternity members inviting members of different sororities to COVID-positive parties and rush events. NC State recruitment process is still up in the air. On August 27th, the school's fraternity and sorority life department sent an email telling members that IFC and Panhellenic recruitment would begin September 18. They do not say whether it will be held in person or online. Fraternity member Thomas Walsh says the response was far too slow, and to be honest, I haven't seen a sizable response yet. Administration takes time, but this was a situation where I had hoped the university would have immediate responses to immediate problems. All right, on to Tomasi McDonald's cover story, A Tale of Two Signs. Want to know how gentrification in Durham works? Just read the signs. Two different kinds of for sale signs have been popping up in a traditionally black Durham neighborhood in the shadow of downtown, and they neatly illustrate the forces that are turning such neighborhoods white. The first kind is a red and white placard made of hard plastic, like the one in the front yard of a bungalow on the 100 block of Lodge Street in South Durham. The home's gray exterior shingling is starting to buckle. The handsome charcoal gray Cadillac Coupe de Ville parked in front is missing a license plate, and the grass is growing tall in the sloping backyard. A cute little toddler stands in the doorway next to a pit bull puppy. They're both smiling and are the same height. When a prospective buyer arrives to ask about the home, a teen boy comes outside and tells the buyer to call the number on the for sale sign. The home, built in 1925, has an estimated value of $156,200. And is listed for sale at $289,000. The second kind of sign is more professional-looking, like the one that sits a few blocks away, in front of a two-story craftsman home with a white picket fence at the end of the 200 block on West Piedmont Street. A man who is arguing with his girlfriend stopped to tell the Indy that the home's former owner attended Howard University, but put the home up for sale because of crime and gunshots in the neighborhood. This home, built in 2017, is on sale for $448,700. The first kind of sign represents the forced exodus of working-class African-Americans from the inner city, driven by skyrocketing property taxes, an influx of new homes that are far beyond their financial reach at neighbors who no longer look like them. They're selling their homes to developers and individuals for above, but not far above, market value. The second kind of sign represents a shift in who lives in the inner city and what that means. Moreover, it represents the developers or wealthy individuals who buy these houses, renovate them, and sell them at prices that far exceed what the original owners received or can afford. Affluent whites of the sort who fled to the suburbs during the 1960s and 70s now want to live near downtown, especially faced with Durham's housing shortage elsewhere in the city. And so black residents are being shunted off to exurbs. This is the inverse of 20th century white flight, when white people fled racially mixed urban regions, leaving them impoverished for suburbs and exurbs. Now instead, we have gentrification, where white people are fleeing the suburbs and exurbs for racially mixed urban regions, enriching them, but not to the benefit of longtime black residents. But it doesn't have to be this way, and it still doesn't if the political will to address it at the city level can be found. The current gentrification of black neighborhoods in Durham may well be even more insidious than the urban renewal programs that displaced thousands of black homeowners and hundreds of black-owned businesses more than half a century ago. In 1962, voters approved an $8.6 million bond referendum to finance water, sewer, and street improvements in the Haiti district. The goal, per recommendations by UNC's Chapel Hill Department of City and Regional Planning, was to clean up and modernize 200 acres of Haiti to improve the city's tax base and make room for the planned East-West Expressway. The referendum won tremendous black support, in the face of white detractors who, quote, take delight in keeping a Negro section of the city a blighted area where they have the delight of looking down or turning up their noses at Negroes, as Lewis Austin, the legendary publisher and editor of the Carolina Times, wrote. Urban renewal at least held out a promise to improve the quality of life in black communities, though it was never fulfilled. But forces of gentrification today hold no such promise in struggling neighborhoods where wealthier white newcomers who want to live near downtown are buying homes in formerly all-black enclaves, driving up property taxes to levels older residents can't afford. Nor, after selling their homes, can they afford newly refurbished ones that often sell for $250,000 to $500,000. Even when black and brown members of the city's working class garner pre-approved housing loans, they are easily outbid for homes in their neighborhoods by more affluent newcomers. As a result, realtors are increasingly directing them to towns like Graham, Mebane, Butner, and even Henderson, where they can purchase more home for their money. The anger and frustration felt by black residents who are being priced out of the city is understandable. History is alive in the Bull City. Old-timers eagerly share archival documents and film footage of the traditionally black Haiti district south of downtown, while a new generation has declared its intent to rebuild Black Wall Street as it was when the black community's commerce and quality of life earned the praise of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, who rarely agreed on anything. Cynics say it took Japanese people less time to rebuild a country ravaged by two atomic bombs than it has to rebuild Haiti. Gentrification in hardscrabble black communities was inevitable after a long series of broken promises, the federal government reneging on granting black freedom, 40 acres and a mule at slavery's end, redlining at the onset of FDR's New Deal, and the proposed urban renewal that had its start in 1949 and 1954 when Congress authorized federal funding for urban slum clearance and new construction. In Durham, that new construction was conspicuously absent, save for that East-West Expressway that cleaved the heart of 200 acres of Haiti, perhaps destroying it forever. Community organizer Lamont Lilly, whose activism and political life were chronicled in the Indy last week, calls the white homeowners who have arrived from all over the country to buy homes along the Fayetteville Street corridor colonizers, with little regard for how their presence is uprooting a community that has been cheated out of a fundamental birthright, the sanctuary of a home. Trust me, he says, families are being destroyed. Last month, Carmen Williams was among the city planning commissioners who voted unanimously to not recommend rezoning requests for the proposed development on nearly 900 homes in North Durham's traditionally black Bragtown community. Before casting her votes, Williams chastised a representative of one of the developers who made a last-minute offer of $100,000 to be split by the city's Affordable Housing Fund and the Bragtown Community Association, whose members shared their concerns about being forced out of neighborhoods that were settled by freedmen who had labored at the Stagville plantation about 10 miles away. Williams said. You see opportunity, but you don't see options. She wondered why the funds could not be used to create more affordable homes. You don't see the community. More and more people everywhere have decided they can't be bought. It did not have to be this way, and preserving the Haiti district could have had an enormous citywide impact. North Carolina Central historian Jerry Gershenhorn writes in his biography, Louis Austin and the Carolina Times, that before urban renewal, quote, Durham's planners argued that Haiti was an economic and aesthetic drag on the city and a detriment to public health, safety, morals, and welfare. Gershenhorn adds that in contrast, many blacks viewed Haiti with its 4,000 homes and 500 businesses, quote, as a vibrant, though poor, African-American community, which suffered because of overcrowding and inadequate housing that was supposed to revitalize the substandard housing in much the same manner as gentrification is doing now. Henry McCoy, who's director of entrepreneurship at NC Central's business school, previously told the Indy that the loss of Haiti is incalculable. McCoy said, we are talking about literally billions of dollars in lost economic value for the Haiti community that could have resulted from expanding as the macroeconomic landscape expanded. Black Durham was denied the economic standing that it had built over the course of the century before the East-West Expressway came through. Working-class black families throughout Durham's urban core say they are now targets of an urban land rush, besieged with unsolicited calls and visits to their homes from strangers who want to buy them out. And they are selling. Entire blocks of black neighborhoods are now white. In East Durham, along Guthrie Street, on the 1100 block of Dunston Avenue in South Durham, Walltown to the north, and pretty much all of the south side along the edge of downtown. Durham Housing Authority Director Anthony Scott touts this as a success story because of mixed income development, as opposed to herding low-income residents into a neighborhood destined to be bedeviled by poverty and crime. Success for whom, though? There's a trundle-down complex on Fargo Street where two townhomes are priced at more than $150,000, and a single room farther up the street is renting for nearly $800. Nate Baker is an urban planner and a senior associate with Clarion Associates in Chapel Hill. He also serves on Durham's City Planning Commission. He says the inner city and who gets to live there is being redefined in Durham and in similar cities across the country. He says, for decades, the inner city typically referred to historic residential neighborhoods where low-income, black, and working-class people lived. But the inner city also encompassed neighborhoods that were walkable, close to transit, and near services. These areas, he added, were notorious for both public and private disinvestment. But as investment shifted to downtown and market preferences shifted toward walkable places, the inner cities that whites once fled became the natural locations for revitalization. Baker understands the long-time residents' frustration and anger. He says, gentrification now means that any efforts to make neighborhoods better threatens the ability of low- and middle-income residents to remain where they are. Imagine the injustice of living in neighborhoods neglected by society for decades, only to be forced out of your neighborhood by the very investments that residents needed all along. Aya Shabu is a dancer and writer who recently purchased a home that's undergoing renovations in East Durham's Hyde Park neighborhood. The married mother of two is the founder of Whistle Stop Tours, with stops in storied African-American neighborhoods. I am seething, Shabu said last week while walking along West Pettigrew Street, where she's creating a new tour that will explore Black Durham's involvement with the Green Book. Shabu walked past the Bull House, a luxury apartment complex, near the intersection of Fayetteville and Pettigrew Streets, where white tenants walked in and out. The rear of the impressive housing complex straddles Jackie Robinson Drive. The apartments that rent between $1,300 to a little over $5,000 a month are far beyond the capability of people who have lived in the community for decades. Shabu is also frustrated because of what used to occupy the sprawling stretch of land where the building sits. There was the black-owned Biltmore Hotel, a glittering jewel in the crown of the old Haiti district, which was called the, quote, finest Negro hotel in America. It shared space along Pettigrew Street with bars, restaurants, gas station, a drugstore, dry cleaners, a theater, and the Carolina Times, before it was burned to the ground in the late 70s in a suspected arson. Shabu says, we can pretty much predict where black people will be economically 20 to 50 years from now. She calls gentrification in Durham black erasure. Baker says, a question that's not asked enough is, to where are gentrified residents being displaced? The answer to that question is further away, he says. Further away from jobs, transit, services, and quality of life opportunities. In Durham, it means that the poorly serviced exurbs, where the cost of travel is higher, to the county, to Graham or Burlington. Vanessa Mason Evans, who lives in North Durham, echoes Shabu's unease. She says, it's like they are trying to erase all of the blacks out of the communities where they have dwelt for years. It's like they want us back on the plantation, but in a different way. Mason Evans is the chair of the Bragtown Community Association. At slavery's end, her family arrived in Bragtown from plantations in Chatham and Granville counties. The family worked hard and bought more than 10 acres of land in the neighborhood. Today, her family members own homes, a convenience store, and a gray concrete building on the land purchased by their forebears. For nearly 20 years, Mason Evans has dreamed of transforming that building into a small business mall. She envisions an organic fruit and vegetable market, a barbershop, ethnic-flavored restaurants, a nail salon, and a tailoring shop. We have had dreams for years for what it would look like, she says. But Mason Evans and her family have repeatedly been denied loans needed to develop the property. She says there was always a reason why we couldn't qualify for a loan. One time it was our credit score, then it was something else. Then they told us if we did this thing or that thing, we could qualify. We just gave up. She thinks her application would have been approved if she were white. She says, I know it would have made a whole lot of difference. Blacks have a harder time getting loans, and I think that's a way to deter you. Then it becomes a challenge to replenish finances and just trying to hold on to what you have, and that's with a lot of black people. Baker says the private sector and real estate capital monopolize the building of cities that does not contribute to healthy, truly just and democratic society. But the public sector, particularly local government, has, quote, an incredibly powerful tool in its arsenal, the power to regulate real estate through zoning that has had a well-known history of dividing people by race and class. Durham's zoning and subdivision regulations make up the city's Unified Development Ordinance. Baker calls it the rules, or DNA, that shape the human form. He and his fellow members have lobbied for double the amount of sidewalks in new developments, along with making them more transit accessible and green sustainable. And he says there's much more work to be done beyond tweaks or even comprehensive overhauls to our planning system and regulations. Baker points to tangible actions that include local government support of neighborhoods that are resisting the efforts of, quote, well-capitalized developers and unyielding racist market forces. Baker also thinks the city needs a more institutionalized system of neighborhood planning, where residents are engaged by planners and organizers to create a vision of their community that calls for, quote, new policies, regulations, programs, and metrics to achieve that vision. Finally, Baker says the city needs a system to address controversial large-scale development projects. He suggests that the city or a consultant hired by the city should conduct a charrette process with developers, impacted residents, and other stakeholders, so there is the fair mediation that can help all people, all parties, achieve the best development. And he continues, our planning system shouldn't be a regime that greases the wheel for real estate capital. It should work endlessly to achieve a humane and democratic city inspired equitably by residents. Well, now we have an opportunity to hit some cultural articles. This one, first music article written by Brian Howe, For Whom the Bass Tolls. Meet the unsung hero of the Triangle's Indie Americana Vanguard. Quick, what to H.C. McIntyre, Skylar Goudage, Jake Xerxes Fussell, Nathan Bowles, The Dead Tongues, Josh Kimbrough, and Blue Cactus all have in common? The obvious answer is that they're some of the Triangle's most notable artists working at the crossroads of indie rock and Americana. The less obvious answer is Casey Toll. Over the last 8 years, the 33-year-old Durham bassist has lent his discreet but distinct style to records and shows by all of them and more. Most recent was Eno Axis, where Toll's wide welling interviews, where Toll's wide welling intervals lend majestic scale to McIntyre's tangled art country lowlands. Before that was Cinema, where his dark oiled tone fits perfectly with Goudage's chrome and moonlight sound. But really, Toll has a way of vanishing into records. His parts help songs stand out without standing out themselves, and he's sought for the warm but laconic presence that infuses his playing. Though his name has never graced an album cover, his placid patience almost subliminally runs through a rich vein of local music. He's the Triangle's secret timekeeper, and it's time we learned what makes him tick. Tall and squarely built with a soft, faintly bemused smile, Toll is too modest for flashy origin. He grew up in Wilmington, where he started playing electric bass because all his friends had electric guitars and somebody had to bite the bullet. In middle school, he played at skate parks in a punk band called Eat Crap and Die. In high school, he was entranced by the high-concept indie rock of the early 2000s, Modest Mouse's The Moon in Antarctica, The Flaming Lips, The Soft Bulletin, but he also earned a little weekend scratch as a bassist for hire in cheesy cover bands playing beach bars. He reasons, I feel like there's always a need for bass players, which is kind of evidenced by why I picked it up. All the while, he was also learning acoustic bass, first in school orchestra, then under the mentorship of jazz bassist Herman Burney, who was a friend of his parents. This was Toll's path to UNC Chapel Hill, where he earned a bachelor's degree in music with an emphasis on jazz performance. He started to emerge on the local scene as he finished school near the end of the 2000s. He hung around Night Sound Studios in Carrboro, doing session work for jazz and folk musicians. He got hired onto tours by Dallas country singer Christy Krueger and Brian Vander Ark from The Verve Pipe. Above all, he began his two most lasting partnerships. One is with Goudage, now his longtime significant other, in an early indie folk band called Harmute, and on through her two eponymous records. The other's with McIntyre, a collaboration that now spans her two eponymous albums and the two Mount Moriah albums. Jeff Crawford is the original Mount Moriah bassist who handed the torch to Toll. Toll says, I don't think I would have been nearly as quick to get a foothold in the music scene here without Jeff's influence. Learning his bass lines from the first Mount Moriah record definitely shaped my playing for the better. Crawford, who has recorded at his studio with Toll many times since then, calls him, quote, the ideal bassist, very technically sound, but always serving the song thoughtfully without seeking credit. He's definitely an unsung hero and never seeks out the spotlight, so it's overdue for him to receive it, Crawford adds. Indeed, Toll never plays six notes, where two will do, and he dispenses words just as judiciously, especially when talking about himself. It's more enlightening to ask his friends and watch them chase him down long corridors of adjectives, as if something essential about him were always just out of reach. Jenks Miller, the guitarist of Mount Moriah, calls Toll a massively talented, egoless giant and giant-hearted guy, while McIntyre ventures, dependable, loyal, mellow, disciplined, and compassionate. He truly plays music for the playing of music, she says. He's not interested in accolades or rubbing elbows up ladder rungs. He's a gentle spirit. Shy, he plays so emotionally, yet also technically, tastefully, yet also experimentally, and always in service to the song, not his ego. In the late 2000s, Toll was working as a booth attendant at a parking garage in downtown Chapel Hill, where Miller often parked with a drum kit or amp in his backseat. Gradually, they began to make small talk about music. Casey and I are both pretty shy, Miller says. I don't think we knew each other's names at first. He would squeeze his bass into the tiny parking booth to practice during his downtime. In 2010, well before its anticipated debut album came out, Mount Moriah was offered a tour supporting the Indigo Girls. But Crawford, their bassist, was settling in to build Arbor Ridge Studio in Chapel Hill. McIntyre had also gotten to know Toll while they were both playing in a concert based on Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. We got on easy, McIntyre says. It was obvious he had a hunger for music, that he was really talented and had this eager curiosity to put himself in new experiences. The next time Miller found Toll in the parking booth, he asked him to join Mount Moriah for the second leg of the Indigo Girls tour. Like Crawford, Miller would leave an indelible imprint on Toll. Toll says, I'd like to think my specialty is finding a simple way to complement whatever else is going on. I probably learned that from Jenks when I started playing with Mount Moriah, who emphasized the less is more approach, to be loud and present, but not necessarily play a lot of notes. Toll's first album with the band was Miracle Temple in 2013, when he cautiously felt his way into McIntyre and Miller's well-established dynamic. But while they were drawing him out of his shell, he was expanding theirs, Miller said. Casey was still very withdrawn then. He barely spoke at rehearsals, and Heather and I really had to work to draw him out. But his musical skill and work ethic were already there. Mount Moriah was writing music that referenced 70s rock and folk and later cowpunk stuff, and Casey had that down. But his jazz background helped push us out of our comfort zone. Heather and I are both largely self-taught. He could suggest chords or bridges we wouldn't have considered in our intuitive mode of writing. By the time of recording How to Dance in 2016, Toll felt more confident as a member of the band, someone who shaped its sound rather than just pulling it off. By then, it seemed he'd grasped what mattered in the music, what it fundamentally was. Miller says, one of Casey's strengths is navigating a space between the root notes and Heather's vocal melodies, which were always meant to be the focus of the songs. This allows the arrangements to support the vocals without requiring as much activity from the guitars. As a guitar player who likes space, that's always made me happy. That was the last Mount Moriah record to date before McIntyre released her two eponymous albums, Lionheart and Eno Axis, with a whole new band, except for one steadfast person. He's been my rock and a best friend for a decade now, she says of Toll. Collaboration insists you operate vulnerably and without hesitation. It requests trust and accountability. It requires respect, and it engenders ultimate intimacy. At this point, our connection has moved well beyond a musical partnership. He is a soulmate. Toll still does plenty of work for hire. Last year was largely occupied by touring with the rock band Strand of Oaks. He was also joining a piano player for biweekly jazz gig at the Eddie in Saxapa Hall until the coronavirus shut down. He's not too picky about his money gigs, and when he commits, he's all in, whether it's a self-released folk session or a big album on Merge. Crawford says, Casey was always willing to work on any project, and no matter the level of prestige, he gave each project equal and thorough attention. But playing with friends or friends of friends keeps him too busy to do much he doesn't want to do. For instance, Blue Cactus, the cosmic country duo of Steph Stewart and Mario Arnaz, originally had a third member, Nick Vandenberg, who wanted Toll for their self-titled 2017 record. Stewart and Arnaz didn't know him, but admired his work with Mount Moriah and Goudache. Stewart says, he's the type of player who shows up to the first rehearsal with charts he made for himself and hardly needs them since he's already internalized the music. Casey has the most gentle, clever approach to suggesting new ideas in a way that almost makes you believe you're the one making the suggestion. Josh Kimbrough, whose recent acoustic guitar album, Slither, Soar, and Disappear, was produced by Crawford, found the same balance of preparedness and freedom in Toll. He says, "We knew Casey would bring a certain magic and X factor to the recording. He knew the songs and the changes very well when he got to the studio. He brought in a palpable intensity. He was focused on getting inside of each song and finding the right feel. He added the perfect backbone and spontaneity." Toll has three basses, two electric and one upright. His oldest electric bass, a 1970s Ampeg model called the Little Stud, has a rich local pedigree. If Toll remembers correctly, he got it for his first Mount Moriah tour after it had been baptized in many Chapel Hill bands by James Wallace and Wiley Pamplin. But over the last few years, Toll has been using a Fender P bass with a jazz pickup more often. He says, "I've always gone for a heavy, smooth tone. I'm trying to get a little bit of a punchier sound just based on some of the stuff I've been touring with. And the Little Stud is super heavy and hard to travel with." He's just as pragmatic about the laminate plywood upright bass that Herman Burney found for him at David Gage's New York shop more than 20 years ago. Toll doesn't even know the brand name. He just knows how it plays. And basses are really expensive. Pardon me. "Also, I think it sounds great," he says. "It was new when I got it, so the sound kind of continually opens up and feels more resonant, to me at least, as it gets older." He used to stick to electric or acoustic, depending on the session, but in recent years he's been mixing them up more. He mostly plays the upright with Nathan Bowles and Jake Xerxes Fussell, which befits their old-time context, and mostly plays electric with Goudage, though McIntyre's latest record features both. These are the groups that Toll plays in rather than with. He appeared on Fussell's prior two records, adding his musicological knowledge to that of the scholarly Southern folk and blues musician with the nimble Telecaster. Fussell, who calls Toll his favorite bass player on planet Earth, as well as a superb human being, knows him well enough to glimpse something mischievous darting behind his mild facade. Fussell says, "Whenever he speaks, which is sort of seldom, it's very quiet and sincere, and he makes direct eye contact, and often he's sort of smiling, and you'll think that you really need to listen to this heartfelt and tender story. But after you adjust your ears, you realize that what he's telling you is a completely absurd narrative about how the behavior of a certain dragonfly he's been observing in his backyard has been concerning him lately." Though backing Fussell, Toll met banjoist Nathan Bowles, whose cerebral take on string band music calls for someone who is both earthy and arcane. Toll joined Bowles on Plainly Mistaken, released to national acclaim in 2018. And Bowles says, "Everyone has a different idea of a musician's musician, but I think myself and others enjoy playing with Casey because he strikes a very rare balance of studiousness and playfulness. Casey's a real woodshedder, a dedicated practicer of his craft, but he's also not bound by strict technique concerns or idiomatic restrictions. He uses his tools. He doesn't let his tools use him." But probably no one knows Toll better than Skylar Goudage after their creative, professional, and domestic lives has been mingled for so long. Goudage says, "It's endlessly rewarding and, of course, always also very difficult to work in creative collaboration with someone who you're in a relationship with. I don't think it can work if you don't both have the utmost respect for one another's artistry, because you can't lie to one another about anything. The creative relationship is kind of another partner in the relationship." Goudage says she trusts Toll's ear, even if they disagree, which they seldom do on creative matters. Instead of driving each other crazy as working musicians, they understand each other's drives and habits. She says, "Casey's relationship to music is so encompassing, with such a complete technical mastery, but he's also a very sensitive player, and it's important to him to be both in tune with what the song is trying to do and also to generously listen to what the other players are trying to communicate." To date, Toll's artistry is defined in relation to others, and at last we asked him the question everyone asks him eventually. After all the records featuring Casey Toll, will we ever hear the Casey Toll record? He says, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have those aspirations. It's part of my practice rituals to work on ideas I think could be something of my own. Sometimes they end up being incorporated into projects I'm working on. That's just the way playing music with a lot of people is. Gudash points out that Toll's mother is a professional painter, and she thinks this shaped his mindset about music, bifurcated between professional and personal. I think he grew up with this very realistic working man's approach to the practicalities of making a living as an artist. And I think this also drove home that the art making itself and your relationship to your craft is a very personal practice, almost outside of that, something I watch him engage in almost as a spiritual practice. For Toll, it seems, that's more than enough. If being the X factor on other people's records is an impediment to developing something all his own, he's characteristically calm and generous about it. He says, it would be an impediment if that was a huge desire I felt I was missing out on. But I've been lucky to hit a sweet spot to play with a lot of people I care about, whose music I feel like is really important. I feel pretty comfortable adding what I can. Well, I believe I have time to read most of an article from the food and drink section about the Black Farmers Hub on Cross Street in Raleigh. Sarah Edwards wrote this column. On a recent Sunday afternoon, music filled the Black Farmers HUB as customers browsed wooden boxes of fruit and vegetables and shelves scattered with local honey, spice blends, sauces, grits, and grape juice. It was the grand opening of Southeast Raleigh's newest grocery store at 1409 Cross Street, the latest venture from Demetrius Hunter and his partner, Priscilla Nguera. And the mood was lively. A group of masked customers sat in the corner of the store, fanning themselves, while in the adjoining room, a DJ booth live-streamed music from Nairobi, Kenya, where Ngera's brother, Ezekiel Mutuki, a.k.a. DJ Muez, was playing a set. The store opened at 1 p.m., Hunter says. People started lining up at 12:45. Southeast Raleigh is designated as a food desert by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The mission of Hunter's new grocery is to make fresh food affordable to the community and support local farmers in the process. All produce and products are sourced from local Black farmers and businesses. Hunter has been distributing food in Southeast Raleigh since 2013 when he founded the community-based mobile market Grocers on Wheels. But his family's connection to food justice and the land stretches back to the early 19th century. His great-great-grandmother, Embert Turner Sanders, was born into slavery in 1836. Following the Civil War, she and her husband purchased a 39-acre plot of land in Johnston County where they began a peach and plum orchard. Decades later, during the Great Depression, Hunter's grandfather would travel to Raleigh to sell the farm's produce, followed by Hunter's father, Zelb, a World War II veteran who transitioned to selling vegetables full-time after retiring in 1980. Demetrius Hunter remembers riding around in his father's truck as the pair made delivery trips around the city, watching his father build relationships with residents, often extending credit. Hunter says, Grocers on Wheels delivered to the same communities as my dad did, and we still do that delivery service. And the brick and mortar was so important, especially during the pandemic. Fresh food was a need 40 years ago in Raleigh when his father was making those produce runs, and it continues now. Food deserts, defined as a community in which the poverty rate is 20% or greater, and in which 33% of the population lives more than 1 mile from a supermarket, are pervasive across the state. In 2014, there were at least 349 food deserts, a federal study revealed, and these days, North Carolina ranks as the 10th hungriest state in the country, with particularly high rates of food insecurity amongst children and seniors. Over the years, several major chains laid down roots in Southeast Raleigh only to close their doors. In 2012, two such stores shuttered, a Kroger on New Bern Avenue and one on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, deepening area food insecurity. A Save a Lot opened in 2015 in the Martin Luther King Boulevard space before closing in 2019. Alternative grocery models have helped fill the gap, including the Fertile Ground Cooperative, which hosts family markets and has been working since 2011 to establish a member-owned grocery store. In 2013, Hunter formed Grocers on Wheels alongside the public health advocate and performance artist Anita Woodley. The organization, a partnership with local farmers and Wake County Human Services, delivers produce and healthy baked goods directly to homes, senior centers, and social service providers. Since the onset of the pandemic, the group has delivered between 300 to 400 boxes of produce a week, Ngara says. The hospitality industry was hit really hard by the pandemic, Priscilla Ngara says, and most of these chefs don't have jobs. So we want to put it out there where we can help the community and they can come and show their talent and also do a demo as they also show people what we have in the store. Food insecurity has been unforgiving during the pandemic and will likely get worse as CARES protections expire. Emergency federal interventions have helped lessen the blow, but only temporarily. Hunter's efforts, in contrast, will continue to build on the relationships his father and ancestors began and create an organization with longevity that supports Black makers and builds community. Having a building to call home anchors those efforts, not unlike the plot of land in Johnston County did for Hunter's family 150 years ago. Hunter and Guerra hope to run events in the new space, including cooking demos that feature one-pot recipes across the African diaspora, like mukimo, a stew made with boiled potatoes and greens. They also have a vision of hiring young people to work with them and carry on the mission. Ngara's 17-year-old daughter, Immaculate Wanjiku, does much of the grant writing and marketing for the grocery. On opening day, she was busy showing customers around the store and detailing where certain vegetables come from. Hunter says, "This is part of our legacy and how it should continue on. But I want it to be above and beyond me, you know, bigger than me and my dad." Ooh, here comes the crew. They're coming in to remove our carousel to take back to Pullen Park. And our music must end soon, along with our broadcast, which is available as a podcast on ncreadingservice.org after our first presentation. And we hope you will return to hear Indie Week's next issue, read by John Feddersen. And so long for now.